Welcome to Loading the Bar with physical training experts Parker McBride and Matt Wasko. Our Fit Lifestyle podcast covers the science of nutrition and fitness, together with the challenges we all face to be disciplined. We'll guide you through the minefields of fads and gimmicks and all manner of BS that tempt us in today's fitness world. Ready to begin? Then let's start loading the bar.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Loading the Bar podcast. Parker McBride here, joined as always by my co-host Matt Wasko. How's it going today, Matt?
It's going real good. Episode 32.
It's exciting.
Who knew?
Yep, we made it all the way, and we're coming into the fall. This is Labor Day weekend. We're heading into football season. Lots of exciting things going on right now.
So I'm going to say this right now because we have a couple guests that have been difficult to lock in, but I'm hoping next week we have two young ladies that we've been trying to get on here for quite some time. So I won't say their names, but they should know that we're talking about them and that I'm hoping next week is the week.
That'd be very exciting. They'd be a great addition to the podcast.
Absolutely. They have great stories to tell.
That's right. And Thursday, this coming Thursday, is the Chiefs opener.
Yeah, it is.
Against Baltimore Ravens.
I should know more than I do, but is Baltimore going to be good this year?
I mean, I assume they were in the AFC Championship game with the Chiefs last year.
All right. It tells you how close I've been following football in the last couple of years. But anyway, my son gives me a hard time because I bet he asked me the other day, he says, I bet you can't even name five quarterbacks. I'm like, oh, yeah, you're probably right. I can't. I don't follow it like I used to.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I'll certainly be watching just to see how they do. All right. So we are going to go ahead and dive into our Fit Focus today.
Yep.
And I found a very interesting article. The title really caught my eye, and I said, we've got to talk about this one. The title of the article says, Why Nutrition Studies Keep Contradicting Each Other.
Yeah.
That's extremely interesting because that is a topic we brought up on this podcast before, and I'm sure most, if not everybody, has noticed that, right? You see a headline, oh, study says this, study says that. You know, this article reads off, says, you know, studies say eggs are good for you. Studies say eggs are bad for you. Studies say wine is good for you. Studies say wine is bad for you. Coffee is a superfood, but coffee is also damaging to your health. You should never eat saturated fat, but it's really not that bad, according to science. There's all these back and forths. This is good. This is not good. Do this, do that. And it's just a mess that we cannot parse as individuals.
Well, I think, especially this day and age, we have what we would classify as agendas. And agendas are usually built upon greed, because people are greedy and it's all about the mighty dollar. So when you can control what studies their results are, then you also can impact your bottom line. So, you know, a lot of these studies say they're impartial, we've even discussed some of this, you know, like who's funding it, right? You know, how was the study done? And this article kind of goes in a little more detail, you know, and it struck me because the eggs bad for you is still there's a high portion of the population that believe eggs are bad for you. I've been asked that question at this gym particularly. Of all the times I've discussed eggs, at least half the people thought, oh, I don't want to eat too many eggs, so that my cholesterol. And mm-hmm. I nipped that in the butt right away. I says, one, I just saw a study the other day that was talking about cholesterol, how that used to be, used to be in the medical community that 350 on your cholesterol was okay. 350.
Wow.
You know, because your brain's made mostly of fat, mm-hmm. and you need cholesterol for that brain. And if you don't, then you start having Alzheimer's disease. So they're wanting to get you down to 150, and it's not nearly as effective. So, you know, when they start saying that, you know, 250, 275 is too high, There's a lot of other factors you need to consider.
Well, think about all the things that we've found out in the last few years, few decades about the medical industry, how they have steered us the wrong way. And so why would we sit here and just believe if the doctor says, oh, your cholesterol is a little high, it should be in this range? Not that that's not true, but why should we just take that as gospel without any further research?
Right.
And that's where I think that comes in, because that's extremely interesting. And going back to what you're talking about funding the studies, you talk about eggs, right? The study saying eggs are bad. Well, let's say I'm a egg company, right? And all of a sudden the cereal company does a study to show that cereal is better than eggs.
Right.
And this is a little bit of the problem that we can talk about later. But if you're one company and you sell a food, and another company has put out a study, funded a study, like they paid for it, and then they got the result they wanted because they paid for it, and it tells you that your food is bad, what are you going to do?
You're going to do your own study.
You can do your own study, right, and get the opposite result to say your food is good.
Right.
And so this is one of the reasons why we have study wars. It's like, instead of, you can't just come out and say, well, no, our food's good for you. Well, because no one's going to believe you. You have to have evidence. So then you'll do a scientific study to get your evidence. So it's almost like fighting in studies.
Well, it's kind of like everyone says, you know, the word facts and the words evidence, those have taken a black eye. They've been mitigated because, you know, now people will call facts, or should say, let me reverse that. People call lies facts, you know, and they'll say, see this study, see what it says. And you're like, yeah, but now you have to actually research the study. How was it put together? So,
yes,
you know, it's like, if we, one of the things that we have that we should always use is history. Okay. How's man always been, how they always lived, how they've always functioned, and what, you know, developing, you know, like for example, a lot of the toxins that are in our food to make them last longer and all that stuff, you would think we would figure out, you know, if we're having issues with it, maybe we should go back the way it was. It's healthier, we live longer, and we don't have the diseases that we have now. And, you know, so, you know, when we talk about facts, you know, because people, let's say we're on opposite ends here. You say, well, here's my studies. Boom, I put them in the middle, and you put your studies out there. Well, okay, now what do we do?
Whose study counts?
Yeah, whose studies count? Who's the arbiter of the studies? You know, I mean, you know, that's kind of where we're at now.
That is. That's absolutely where we are, and that's where... like you said, thinking about a study, if it's a brand new product, kind of like we talked a while back about Ozempic and the studies about it, but the more than that, the lack thereof, because it's so new, there isn't a lot of long-term studies out there about the effects of Ozempic. So maybe we go into that with the more skeptical approach. Mm-hmm. But when a study comes out about eggs, a product that not only is naturally occurring in our environment, not, you know, it's not processed whatsoever, but it's a food that people have been eating for presumably thousands of years.
Right.
Right. And we see a study come out saying they're bad. It's like, well, people have been eating them forever. I mean, not that it is, not that they have to be good for you, but we have a little more skepticism on whether that study is accurate or not.
Right.
Because then you take a food like cereal, right? Because I think probably the cereal industry was big on the anti-egg agenda, because if you're not eating eggs, what are you probably going to eat? You're probably going to have cereal.
Mm-hmm.
So
processed cereal.
Exactly. And so we have to come into that with some skepticism to see, okay, they don't want us eating eggs, but people have ate eggs forever. Is there really anything behind this?
I think one of the things that always is the telltale sign, and it's in scripture, know them by their fruits. And that could be a good fruit or a bad fruit, right? So if we eat like crap and we are eating cereal all the time in McDonald's, you know, bad things happen to our body. But what has been done is that blame has been put on other things.
Exactly. It's like if you eat a McDonald's hamburger, what's the bad part of that? And they've been trying to tell us that the bad part of a McDonald's hamburger is the fact that there's red meat in there. Right? Not all the other stuff. Ignore all the other stuff. Right. The sauces and how it's fried and how it's made and everything. Right. You know, it's just the fact that it's red meat. That's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I'm, as far as my blood level in my, and how my system's functioning, I'm at the healthiest I've ever been. And because I eat pretty darn clean, outside of me having to put some carbs in me. I mean, that's why I was telling you last week, I decided instead of me eating breads and pastas and stuff, you know, because I don't trust the stuff they put in there, I'll just eat some straight dextrose. Because I know that it's just dextrose. So now, I have a hard time eating that because it's so damn sweet. And like, I've got to figure another way to eat it. I put like a 30 some grams in my last shake and I just literally almost couldn't drink it. It was the sweetest thing I've ever had. So I'm like experimenting now.
Yeah. So one of the things this article, it doesn't, I mean, we've dove into kind of the shady nature of the studies. But this article also talks about some of the other ways that nutritional studies can achieve bad results if it's not necessarily the bad intentions. And one of the things it talks about is low sample sizes,
mm-hmm.
and that they typically lack funding. So, you know, when they do a nutritional study, if you really want to get good results, you need to study a lot of different people because everybody has different genetics and health levels and different things. You need to study a lot of different people to be able to get a good result on how this affects the population at large.
Right.
And a lot of studies just don't track enough people.
Well, and also went on to say, and this could be have to do with, you know, it says low funding, but it also could do with, you know, the reliance on self-reporting.
Absolutely.
I mean, I can tell you right now that just in my client base, perception and reality are most likely or most often two different things.
100%.
Yeah.
You know, people will say, I mean, it's kind of like at the end of the day, if you talk to somebody in the evening, you're like, oh, what'd you eat today? Like, oh, well, you know, I had this and then I had that. And, you know, it's hard to recall. It's fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't even remember what I had for dinner last night. You know, how many times do you hear people say that? We don't necessarily recall. We eat a lot. We eat all the time. And so it's kind of subconscious.
Right.
And there are things we sometimes eat as habits. I know with people, if you actually track every single thing you eat and you do it accurately, you're going to probably find some things that you didn't even know about.
Yeah.
So you may say, oh, I mean, you know, these people that are self-reporting, oh, I ate this much of this thing or that much, or I was eating healthy. You know, I wasn't eating any junk the whole time, you know, but really they were. And then their results get counted.
Right. The results get counted in their, how they don't know how to perceive their own health sometimes. You know, sometimes people don't realize how good they feel until they feel really bad, or yeah. You know, I mean, and then when they're not sick anymore, they really appreciating feeling good, right?
Yes.
So having experience with different levels of suffering and discomfort is most people, you know, need to have to, you know, in order to gauge how a diet's affecting them.
Yeah. I heard a doctor talking one time. I can't remember who it was, but he was talking about people rating their pain level.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, if he's treating a patient, they're in pain, or patients coming to him with a certain pain, often will ask them to rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. Like, when it's the worst, what is it? And then when it's just a normal, when it's normal, what is it? And he said they don't take people's word for it. They don't ask that question because they're going to like, oh, it's an 8? Okay, then that must be an 8. They ask to get the perception of what the individual feels, and then they understand how to change that based on what the reality is. Now, mm-hmm. they can't actually feel it for you, but they can. They've learned to tell where, you know, some people, if they say it's a 10, it's like really a 5. Because people come in like, oh, it's a 10. It's so painful. And it's like, well, you'd be like down on the floor writhing in pain. Like, wouldn't even be able to speak to me if it was actually a 10, right?
Yeah.
It's probably more like a 5.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's different types of personalities too. You know, there's some people, you know, if they come in and they're really nitpicky about all this stuff and kind of naggy, you know, it's like, they're probably going to overstate their pain.
Right.
You get some like tough old guy, you know, straight face, like, no, I'm fine. You know, his wife dragged him there, you know, and they ask him how painful it is. Like, he probably is going to understate his pain if he doesn't want to be there, right?
Well, I'll give you an example. Some people can tolerate higher degrees of pain.
That too, yeah.
I have this story of when my daughter was playing soccer for this coach, and for the life of me, I can't remember his name, and he played for BYU, and he had a goalie. He was telling me this story one time. His goalie was like another level of, I guess, pain tolerance. And he, during a game, they went for a shot on the goal, and he went to dive. And when he went to dive, the net caught his pinky, and it literally ripped it completely off. I mean, gone, right? So he looks down at it, and he pulls his glove off, and he's like, okay, glove is still in the pinky, or the pinky's still in the glove, right? Mm. So he gets it out of there, and he said, hey, kid, go get me a cup of water. You know, standing on the sideline. So the kid runs and gets him a cup of water. He drops the pinky in the cup and finishes the game. That's another level.
That is another level.
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of one of those things. Now, I mean, I've had what I would consider 8, 9, or 10 pain, where I'm on a gurney and I have an open flesh wound that's pretty deep, and they stick a hypodermic needle right into the wound, and is the worst pain I've ever felt in my life, you know? And I'd probably get that at 8, 9, or 10. But I don't think I want to know what a 10 is.
No, me neither.
Yeah.
Let's see, later in the article, it gets to a point too that kind of hits on what we were talking about, but it says, however, a more sinister issue comes from nutritional reporting and publication bias. Most people get their science from media as opposed to academia. So journalists' headlines must rely on bold rhetoric to capture viewers' attention.
Yeah, the bait and what do you call them? Clickbait.
Yeah, so they may give a really polarizing headline to make you want to click on the article, which you probably aren't even really clicking on it at that point. You're just like reading it and then moving on.
Right.
How many people really read the articles anymore? You see the headline, oh, wow, I didn't know that, and then you move on. When you get down in the article and it's like, really doesn't say that in the article,
well,
the research.
Yeah.
But then the word gets spread.
Yeah, it's almost like it's a stretch to, that the title is a stretch to what the article was actually about.
Yeah, like let's say it's a, like 1% increase in death or something. They're like, oh, death skyrocket from this thing.
Right.
And so they can definitely overstate it. And so it's very important not just to trust the headlines that we see. Look into what these studies are actually saying, but also look into the ways that the studies could be manipulated.
Right, right.
And like I always say, trust yourself.
Mm-hmm.
What you are seeing, what you're feeling, what you're hearing, that's a lot more true than what you're being spoon-fed by the media and by these companies that have an agenda.
Yeah. I think one thing is important to note, just taking one step back before I move forward, because I think it's pertinent to how a lot of people live right now, and that is a lot of people live off processed food, and they don't know what it's like to live off, you know, fresh food. They don't know what that feels like. So the living on processed foods become the norm, right? So, and that's what I mean, perception and reality, right? Your perception of reality is, this is the way I'm supposed to feel. until you do eat something healthy and you realize, wow, it's a massive difference.
Yeah, it's kind of like somebody who says, oh, I eat healthy, but then you ask them what they eat and they basically just go to the grocery store and they buy the stuff that says healthy on the package.
Right.
How healthy is that really?
Not healthy.
Most of the time, no.
Yeah.
Compared to somebody who says, I eat healthy, and then they're eating just like, farm-raised eggs and steaks and that type of stuff all the time.
Yeah.
Fruits and vegetables.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
I would say that's, like you said, perception and reality being two different things is a big difference here, and that's why it's important to rely on your own data, gathering your own data. All right. So that was our Fit Focus. Now we're going to move into our main topic today, and we're going to do a little bit of common questions.
Oh, boy.
So I've got a little list of common questions that I hear, and I'm going to play kind of the client role, and I'm going to ask Matt these questions, and we're going to talk about our perspectives on their answers.
All right. Well, you don't be digging deep here.
Matt does not know the questions, by the way, so I'm just going to hit him with them.
All right.
Okay, Matt, first question. How much cardio should I include in my workouts?
Oh, that's a good question. So the reason I like, well, first let's talk the purpose of cardio, okay? I like cardio from the standpoint that it makes you, the more oxygen efficient you are, is the bet more they'll give you the extra rep, the extra, to push a little heavier, because you're delivering oxygen better to your muscles. And the more efficient that is, the longer you can go. And so I like that because I notice it because right now I would say I'm cardio deficient. And
why is that?
Because I'm not hitting my cardio, guys. that will change, though. That is a missing component to my current program. And I realize it when I'm doing, 315 and I'm repping it out and I'm getting to 5 reps and I'm like, holy crap, I can't breathe. and that'll stop you, right? If I have a better oxygen efficiency, then I get those extra 2-3 reps in. So, and I've noticed that in my lifting, that when I'm at those heavy weights, that oxygen is really important. But so anyway, for my clients, I suggest they, if they have 4 days, 3 days, 4 days, whatever it is, I'd like on the other days, that's my preference. That's not, you don't have to do it that way. My preference is that you're doing cardio on the opposite days, right? And the only reason I say that is that sometimes you'll have someone in here 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and they do an hour workout and then an hour cardio, right? Nothing wrong with that except for the fact that sometimes there's just not enough nutrition to make the distance. And, that's where you really need to know what you're doing nutrition-wise if you're going to work 2.5 hours in the gym so you're not losing muscle mass. But so I usually, if it's 4 days a week, I usually, they're training with resistance. I usually say at least 3 days of cardio. If it's 3 days of training, I'll usually offer 2 or 3 days of cardio.
How long should the cardio last?
Well, I like them to get their heart rate up to if they can keep their heart rate to around 140, and usually this is going to be younger, and then keep their heart rate 140 to 150 beats a minute for, 15 minutes, and then they do it in the morning, they're going to burn a few more calories just for their BMR during the day, because it's like a jump start to the day. So usually you're going to need about 10 to 15 minutes warming up to get there. And once you get there, then you keep it there for 15 minutes and then do about 10 minutes of cool down. So anywhere from, I'd say 40 to 45 minutes is typically what I suggest.
What if I can only make it to the gym 3 days a week? how should I break down my resistance training and my cardio?
Then at that point, I would probably be doing like 45 minutes of resistance and, you know, 30 minutes of cardio. Keep it at 75 minutes.
At the end?
I do cardio at the end, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, a lot of times once you if you do cardio at the beginning, you're not going to do the resistance. Or it's not going to be as efficient or as effective. You won't have the strength gains if you do the cardio first.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what time of the day is best for me to work out? Should I work out in the morning before I go to work? Should I work out after I get off work in the evening? Should I work out on my lunch break? When is the best time for me to work out?
Well, for the body, morning. I'm a believer that working out in the morning, it starts your day. And I have more energy throughout the day when I work out in the morning. I'm speaking from personal experience and also from, you know, certain standpoint, science is that if you're working out in the morning, it wakes you up, the adrenaline gets going, and then you're off and running. So it just creates for a higher metabolism throughout the entire day. When I work out 5-6 days a week, my testosterone's higher. So think about that. If I only work out 2 days a week, I'm sluggish. I'm tired. I don't want to work out the following day. So every day that I don't work out, the next day it's harder for me to work out. So last week, this happened last week. It was a really busy week. A lot of things happening home and the gym. I only worked out 2 days, and that was the first 2 days of the week. And then I didn't work out from like Wednesday on. Every day was harder than the next to get going. Every day I was more tired. And I'm thinking, boy, if I did a testosterone check right now, I bet I'd be like 300. And then this week I've worked out every single day. So I'm on, today will be day 6, and my energy has been through the roof. So yeah, if you can do it, do it in the morning. Now the second part of that that's real important is that some people have to be at work at a very early time. And being at the gym at, you know, 3:30 or 4 in the morning is a tall task. So, you know, getting there at, you know, a noon lunch is, you know, it's, you have to work around your noon lunch, you know, and so you have limitations when you can be there. But the most important thing is that you get it in, you know. But ideally for the body and for the highest potential energy burst during your day, morning is preferable.
I didn't hear you talk about the afternoon or evening workouts much. Mm-hmm. Is that something you wouldn't recommend?
Well, again, if I'm removing the work equation, family life equation, all of that, no, I don't recommend that. Only from the standpoint is that, and I say that, and I have several clients that that's when they work out, right? Because that's what works best for them. But if I had my dithers, I would work out in the morning. You know, and I say that, you know, I'm usually working out about 10 or 11 because that's, I get through with all my clients in the morning. That's when I know I have an hour, hour and a half of uninterrupted time. So that's when I do mine. So me, myself, I have to work around my own work, my own job to get my workout in. In the evening, but the body's still going to process, you're still going to grow muscle if you work out in the evening. It's not like you're not going to grow muscle if you work out in the evening. You're still going to have all those benefits. But your metabolism changes throughout the day, right? And by if you ever notice when you're sick, when I'm sick, okay, I usually don't feel that great in the morning. But about 1 to 3 p.m. in the afternoon, I feel pretty good. You know, I'm like, even though I'm sick, not on anything, I haven't taken anything, right? But I feel pretty good because that's when you're at the highest point of the day. And then by about, I'd say 5 or 6, you start going back down again, right? And so the body has its own levels that helps fight sickness. And it's during the peak time where the sun's up between 1 and 2 is when I feel the best during the day. And then as I go into the evening, I start feeling as crappy as I did in the morning. So that's why it's good to do it in the morning, because then, boom, you're off and running.
I would agree. I've done both. I haven't really ever been a midday, like a lunch break type of workout person,
right.
But I've done both mornings. I've done both evenings. And I've much preferred mornings,
right?
For a lot of the reasons that you mentioned. However, I still was able to achieve really good results in the evening times. It just wasn't for me long term.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've definitely done evenings when I've had a long day and I get it in. I will say my workout times are semi-varied. They're usually between 10 and noon. Every once in a while, it doesn't work out, and I'm like, I got to get something in, and I'll head to the gym close to me and get there at 6 o'clock and get something in.
There was a period of time back in the January, February, March, April, like the whole late winter and springtime, where I wasn't training any clients, and I was able to work out in the morning, and I was working out at 5 a.m.
Nice.
It had been a very, very long time since I had done that. And I loved it. It was great. I would just get up and like head right to the gym. I mean, like not even up for 10 minutes and I'm like in the gym.
You know what the best feeling is about that? Is that when you go at that time, you're like, once the kids get up and your wife get up, then responsibility starts, right? When you beat all that, and you have that freedom in that first couple hours of the morning, you get up early. It's like, this is truly my time, because I don't have to worry about, you know, I mean, well, when they're a baby, they might get up. But I'm just saying is, you know, when they get into the years where they're, you know, sleeping through the night, you know, it's like you can get up at 5 a.m. You got 2 hours.
Yeah.
That you can, it's all you. And then you're ready to go and go home and take on your responsibilities.
Yeah. Yeah. That is very nice. And that's why a lot of people do as early as they do, because, yeah, family, work, I mean, it all gets in the way. And yeah. They can't get away at those times, nor should they. You know, like right. For me, evenings, now that I do have a wife and a kid, I mean, evenings are extremely important. And it's like, I don't want to be gone every evening working out. Like, I want to be home, dinner, and spend time with family and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So that's very important, too. But yep. I do know a lot of young people, single people, they love working out in the evenings.
Right.
You know, they don't really have a whole lot else to do anyway in the evenings during the week. They like to come to the gym that time.
When are you working out right now?
Right now I have a little break on most of my days, like a 6 o'clock break, and I'll usually work out at that time.
Okay.
So I've been working out usually like 6 a.m. If I can get a workout in then I will wait till I'm done with my sessions for the morning. Kind of like what you talked about, where it's more of a 10, 11 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Type of thing,
right?
But yeah, that's okay. typically when I've been hitting it. All right, next question, Matt. How many grams of protein should I be eating?
So this is an interesting one. So I remember when my first early years, what I would hear is that the body can only process 40 grams of protein, right? And then as I did more research, it's more dependent upon how big you are, right? There's and what I've seen work in the gym and what I've seen work with me, right? So like I make a 90 gram protein shake every morning, 90 grams. And I probably don't process all of that, but it doesn't go to waste. The protein's used throughout the body. So it's not like I pee it out or something like that. So I would say, or whatever. Anyway, so the point is that I think don't get stuck on the 40 grams. That's even in our certification. The body can only process 40 grams of protein at any one time. But I've seen work in the gym, not just for me, for a lot of people, they're hammering 60 to 70 to 80 grams of protein, depending. And again, I'm talking about guys who want, if you're eating if you're asking the question, how much protein can you eat? You know, there's either one or two options you're looking at. One, you're limited on how many meals you can have a day. Or two, you're looking to really add muscle, right? If you're looking at how many you only have, let's say you only eat twice a day. And heck, we just had a conversation about this, about a young man who's 300 pounds. And we had and I used your expert brain because I was like, if I give him 100 grams of protein in a meal, how much is that actually going to, you know, because he can eat it, but how much is that going to actually go to the muscle? And as such, since he's such a large person, you know, the conclusion was that he'll probably process most of that. And I guess is that answering your question?
Yeah, so what's kind of the total that I should shoot for?
Oh, I would say if you're trying to maintain, again, I've kind of used a similar system for men and women, but like if you're trying to maintain probably 0.8 grams of protein per body weight, if you're trying to add muscle, you know, you're probably going to be at 1 to 1.2. That's been kind of my measuring stick. I'm at like 1.2 because I've been doing about 240 to 260 a day. And so a lot of my clients, I don't give them 1.2 because a lot of them are not even doing half. So, but ideally, I think you should be, even if you're, you know, as you get older, it gets harder to process protein, but you know, if you want to maintain your muscle mass. So I would, I don't think I have any clients that I suggest, oh, I want you to eat half your protein. I want you at least 0.8. And because a lot of it, and some of them, it takes them a while just to get to that.
So that means if I weigh 200, I need at least 160 grams a day, but preferably between 200 and 240 grams a day?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're wanting to add, if you're a guy and you want to add muscle mass, then yeah, 240. Yeah. Now, if you're young, like I have Bryce, weighs 150 pounds, and the school that wants to offer him a scholarship says he has to come in at 200. Well, he has 2 years to do it. So we pull back all the barriers, and I have him doing 300 plus grams of protein a day. When you're younger, your body's very sensitive to that. And he's actually gained some weight. Last time I saw him, his face is starting to fill out. I said he's getting I can't remember, because I've done a lot of meal plans lately. I think I've given him 3,200, I think.
Calories?
Yeah, 3,200 calories, 300 grams of protein. And I think he's told me he's hitting it. Age, you know, your goals. I just can't see a scenario, unless they're having kidney issues, like their kidneys can't process protein very well, you know. But if your kidneys are healthy, I can't see a situation where I go below 0.8.
Okay, good to know.
All right.
Now I want to know how many calories I should be eating. If I know I should be eating that amount of protein, how should I structure my calories per day?
Well, here is where, if you go online, the amount of advice on macros is endless. You can find 10 different calculators online, and all 10 of them will give you somewhat varied results. I know in a lot of fitness gurus are going to say that get your carbs up and get your fats low. I'm a little bit different mindset. I like to get your carbs low and get your fats high. And the reason for that is fats tend to burn faster. And, you know, if you're in the gym and you've burned up all, you know, done your 1 hour of exercise, you know, you're not going to have those carbs sitting around, right? You're going to be using up all those fats. So I've found that, again, a lot of things we do them because they've worked. And I think of one potential guest or future guest we're going to have on that I gave her a meal plan or macro breakdown over a year and a half ago. And she follows it religiously. And she looks fantastic. You know, she has the plenty of energy, gets through the day. And I approach all my clients pretty much the same way, unless they have, I've had two guys come up to me. One of them was really surprised. He was like, he wanted to cut. He'd been working out a while. This is not the guy that we just talked, Marcel. We were not talking about him, but this is another guy. And he's like, he was pretty strong, you know, about 200 pounds. And he was asking me about macros. And I told him, I was like, well, you're going to have to increase your carbs quite a bit. And to get stronger, if you continue doing what you're doing, he's like 28, you're going to continue to get stronger. But if you really want to get strong, you're going to have to start gaining some weight. And he was like, I don't know if I want to do that. I'm like, well, you know, it's kind of the way the human body works.
So would you say macro breakdown is going to be more important than a calorie total?
Well, yes, I would say your macro breakdown is more important than your calorie total, but you know, obviously what you want to have, make sure you have enough fuel, because calories can, as we discussed before, you can have, you know, 1800 processed food calories and gain weight. And you can have, and all kinds of health issues. You can have, you know, 2,800 or 3,000 calories that are fresh food and have trouble gaining weight, you know? So, it depends on where, yeah. So the macros, talking that through, yeah. I mean, where the numbers are in those macros is going to determine how effective the diet is.
What should my macro ratios be?
Ideally, what I give most people is 40-20-40. So 40% fat, 20% carbs, 40% protein. That's typical what I do. Now, again, I know I'm going to get a lot of argumentation on this. That's just what I prefer. Because I know it's what I've seen work. It's effective. And I usually am able to accomplish all the things I want to accomplish. Now, if you're a baseball player and you're, you know, 20 something and you are working out all the freaking time, then I'm going to get your carbs up, right? So I have a couple guys like that that their carbs are as about the same as their fats. But you know, for, you know, everyday Joes who have a job and a family and they're, you know, 35, 45 years old, I usually try to get their carbs down because when your metabolism is slowed down, you know, if you're in your 20s, you can eat a lot of carbs, you know, and you're probably going to need it to get the size you need if you're in sports or if you just, you know, or take advantage of the fact of your youth, you can eat more carbs. I only have a couple of athletes right now, and most of my clients are going to be in their, you know, 35 and older.
So 40% protein, 20% carb, 40% fat. And if I'm a little bit younger or more of an athlete, you might push the carbs up just a little bit.
I might push them up a lot.
And pull from?
I wouldn't pull from protein.
So pull from fats.
Pull from fats, yeah.
So maybe you would go more of like a 40-40-20, like 40 protein, 40 carbs, 20 fat for athletes.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, because the metabolism's so high, I mean, you know, and I need to get size to them. And that's where I'm at now with these athletes. The kids want to look big, and then they also, for athletic purposes, they have to be bigger. So, you know, I got to add size to them, and then hopefully the trainers, when they get to college, will do their job.
Hopefully,
yeah. When I've had a few people that we both know them. I've had some people that played college football, and I'm like, who taught you that form? And they played college football, or, you know, and I'm like, that was the form they taught you? I'm like, wow. So anyway,
it happens.
Yeah.
So next question, Matt. I do a pretty good job with what I eat for lunch and dinner, but I just can't figure out what to eat for breakfast. What should I eat for breakfast?
Are these people working out first thing in the morning?
Good question. Yes, I am working out first thing in the morning.
Okay. So, I would, if you're working out first thing in the morning, I would eat a little something before you go in. Maybe, you know, some fat, a little bit of carbs, and then maybe 20, 25 grams of protein before you come in. So that's not a super large meal. And then again, within the hour after you finish, sometimes the only reason I say don't eat a massive meal right before you come in is only because that can make you sometimes a little nauseous or sluggish in the gym if you just like had a huge meal right before you walked in the gym. Also timing, try to eat at least an hour before you work out. And you're right over there.
but what should I eat? It's like the food.
Oh, what you should. Okay. I am a fan of doing dairy in the morning.
As in milk dairy? As in yogurt?
Yeah, all of the above. I mean, I do eggs. I do steak. I like steak and eggs. I do that.
For breakfast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't. Now, there's some people that probably wouldn't do some of the things that I do. I'm not locked in personally to a breakfast morning, like the traditional breakfast. I've had a filet in the morning.
You mean you don't eat pancakes?
No.
For breakfast?
I do not eat pancakes. I don't do hardly any bread. I do a little bit of bread right now, like, because I'm trying to gain weight. But I don't do a lot of bread, like very little. So, and I usually tell all my clients that are trying to lose weight, the only thing I'm going to have let you do is Ezekiel or Sprouted. Mm-hmm. I'd stay away from all breads, you know, stay away from all pastas. You know, maybe a jasmine or a rice, but as far as the breads,
So what if I don't like eggs, or and I don't, I can't do dairy. Because believe it or not, this question I have got from multiple people.
Yeah.
And it's one of the more challenging ones that I've ever gotten. What should I eat for breakfast if I don't like eggs and I can't have dairy?
Then I give them non-traditional morning stuff, right?
Exactly. That's your only
option. That's your only option. So I just did this recently for a young lady about a week ago. And she's like, well, that's not exactly true. But I thought she didn't like eggs, but she didn't want to eat too many eggs. She wanted to keep her cholesterol down.
So I had that goes to, back to the beginning.
Yeah, so I had about. To I had to answer that, but I didn't know that at first. I thought she goes, "Well, I don't want to eat eggs," and I'm like, "Oh, well, she doesn't like them." And then as I started talking to her, it's not that she doesn't like eggs; she just doesn't. She's worried about her cholesterol. So, but the point is that I answered that question for her, so she didn't have to worry about it. So now she's not worried about her eggs. But when you get to the point where you're not eating dairy, first thing I'll ask, that I'll do a two-tiered approach. I was like, do you eat dairy from the grocery store? And if they say yes, I says, you need to go to a farm fresh dairy and give that a try. Because I've had clients who can't drink, have issues with the milk, which is heated up really high in the milk in the grocery store. And then you go buy raw milk and they have no problem with it. Okay. So a lot of times people's problem with dairy isn't the dairy. It's what the grocery store has put in the dairy. And so I was like, hey, go to, you know, I'll plug them again and go to Redbridge Methodist Church Saturdays off Holmes from 7 to noon and try that dairy, okay? And let's see if you have the same effects. Because a lot of people, what they think about dairy, it's not the dairy, right? But if they truly just don't like dairy, which there's a lot of different, you know, you got cheats and or cheese and cottage cheese and yogurt and milk and, you know, so it's like, you don't like all of that? But if they're truly that way, then they're going to get a very non-traditional morning.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's going to be breakfast without really feeling like breakfast. Because, you know, if you're going to eat protein, which you want to get protein for breakfast, what are your protein sources? Let's think about that. Your protein sources are meat, eggs, and dairy.
Right.
There's not a lot else that has a high concentration of protein, unless you're talking about like protein powders or protein drinks, protein bars, but that's not really a quality everyday breakfast food. And
right.
So yeah, you're going to be looking at one of those options. So if you're taking out dairy and eggs, you're going to be looking at some sort of meat.
Mm-hmm.
You can be eating meat for breakfast, and that's
or
probably
fish.
Gonna be,
and that's kind of a weird morning, but you could do fish.
Hey. Whatever works.
Yeah,
I usually just tell people if they say they hate eggs, I say, well, that you just got to do it.
Yeah, I've said that too. But I'll say, do you? A lot of it is, it's not that they hate eggs. They're just not. They just can't see eating a lot of them.
Well, you can cook them so many different ways.
Oh, I know.
I mean, there are so many different ways to cook eggs, and so. Even if you get tired of them, cooking them one way, cook them a different way the next time. I mean, maybe find a way that you do like them cooked. I don't know, but
yeah. There's a couple clients I'm pretty close to, and they say, "Well, do I have to eat this?" I'm like, "Yeah, you got to eat this." You know, I've given you some things you like, but yeah. There's some things. I have another lady I did a meal plan for, and she loves pasta. I took all that out. And so she calls me, she's like, no pasta? I'm like, no pasta. I'm like, that's a non-negotiable. Now on Sunday, you can have a small bowl. Scratch that itch on Sunday, but rest that week, no pasta. You know, because pasta was almost a daily, you know, thing for her. And, you know, and then they wonder why can't I lose weight? You know, because you're eating pasta 6-7 days a week. Oof. Yeah.
Okay. Next question. I just started in the gym. How long is it going to take me to see results?
Oh, man. Yeah.
They all ask that, though.
Yeah, no, it's... I usually beat them to the punch. Is that I don't even let them ask me that question. I talk about what the process looks like from the beginning. I usually say, listen, and this is not everybody. The, you know, obviously, the more weight you the more weight you're at, the more you will probably lose some in the first 8 weeks, right? But if you're just, you know, 15, 20, 30 pounds overweight, those first 8 weeks, you're probably not going to see a massive drop, right? Not typically. Sometimes you will. But, you know, if you, I say, because, and especially if you've never been in a gym before, their muscles, like we've talked about this, there's the muscle weight's going to go up. They're going to lose some fat. But after the 8 weeks, give or take, that's when you're going to see this nice drop because the muscles are going to settle down and, you know, you're going to see the weight start to go down. And then so I said, and the reason I'd rather you lose this weight slow than fast is what are you learning along the way? Discipline. The most important component you can have to your life is discipline. So if you do this slow, your BMR is going to go down slow. Because I said this is going to happen. If you lose quick, and let's say you lose all the weight you want inside a month or two, your BMR thinks you're still up here, and you still want to eat like you're up here. So you don't have, I mean, you saw the, between the first and the second month, you've done all this, you know, sacrifice and, you know, struggle, and it's been misery. And then now you got your goal. Now you're happy. But now you have to, you haven't learned to live like that. It's just been sacrifice.
Well, at that point, it's not long enough to have a lifestyle change yet. Because anybody can grit through something for a month. And then if they're looking for that, then they're just looking to be able to go back to normal after that.
Exactly.
And if they go back to normal after, if they lose a bunch of weight in a month and then they go back to normal, then they're just going to go back to the weight that they were.
Exactly.
They're going to gain it all back.
Exactly.
It has to be a lifestyle change over time, and it has to have some delayed gratification in there, some working weeks, months, even a year plus of working without seeing significant results so that then they start to get them.
Exactly.
And then once they start to get them, then it's like, oh, cool, I'm getting the results. But I put in so much work before I got them.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, and so I tell them that within the first, you know, 10, 15 minutes they're sitting down with me, because I know that's going to be a question. So I answer it off the, right off the top.
Yeah, it is the most common question. And even when you tell people that, they it still stays in their mind. Kind of like, oh, am I seeing results fast enough? You know, the scale hasn't really moved. And even if you have that conversation with them up front, they're still kind of asked those questions and things. And so it's important to keep it in mind. It's kind of like a trust the process. You know, like it's a process that's worked for so many people over and over again. Matt and I have helped so many people transform using this style of process. It's going to work. You just have to give it time.
What we need to do is reverse all these questions and have you answer them, because you have a wealth of knowledge.
Well, I wouldn't cut yourself short either. Maybe that's what we'll do next week. You come up with some questions for me next week.
Okay. All right.
Okay. I really want to, next question. I really want to grow my legs, get my legs bigger. What exercises should I be doing?
Well, get your legs bigger. One of the things that, you know, isolation is always good. You know, I'm a big fan of leg press for legs, because it's such a, you know, a quad dominant exercise. And, you know, I like hitting my, I like hitting hamstrings for my clients in a few different ways. You know, outside of the compound movements like, you know, squat, which I'm a big fan of. I've kind of discovered when you, and it's the same as the upper body, when you isolate on all the different muscle groups on the bottom of the leg, and then you go over to squat, you see the benefit. And I've noticed that, you know. Now I've been doing a lot. I mean, I didn't even tell you this. So about a week ago, I hammered my hamstrings. I was doing hamstrings all over the place, and I did some heavy RDLs, man, I could just barely move the next couple of days, you know, because, you know, hamstrings are something I'm working on. So I'm a big fan of RDLs, leg press. You know, so I believe in isolation on those muscle groups to get them big. And as far as to get them big, you got to go heavy. And I guess that, well, that's actually a different question. Are you talking about big and strong, or just want them to be as big as possible?
I mean, a balance of both, big and strong.
Well, then you could take the weight down, you know, and go, you know, not going to failure and just doing higher reps and a decent an RPE 7, and I'm doing, you know, 15 reps on the curls, leg curls, where you're just really getting to where they're swole, right? And you're doing high reps with not a ton of time in between them, you know, but, you know, it's all that makes a difference. Like if you're wanting to go really strong, or you want to get really strong, then sometimes I'll put more time in between those sets so I can get that oxygen built back up and ready to push heavy again. Or if I'm just wanting to really get size to the muscles, like really size, you'll get strong, then I'll probably a little less time and higher reps and a little less weight. Does that make sense?
Yes. Back when I had much larger legs, which we're talking like can't really wear jeans, like big legs.
I've seen this picture of him. He was huge.
But anyway, my leg workout every week was I started with squats, did a few sets of squats somewhere in the 5 to 10 rep range, usually after I warmed up. And I did leg press. Same thing, like 4-5 sets, something like that, working weight up each time, around like 10 to 12 reps on there, going to failure on the last set. RDLs, real heavy, and then hamstring curls and leg extensions.
Yeah.
Extremely heavy, like gassing out whatever I've got left.
Right.
That was it. My leg workouts sometimes would last an hour and a half, even doing just like 5 exercises.
Yeah. And that's kind of, those are the ones you just mentioned are kind of the staples.
Yeah. And I would just do the exact same ones every week.
Yeah.
I'd still be really sore. That was kind of the foolproof method. If somebody said, all I care about is like getting the biggest, strongest legs, I wouldn't really vary their leg day exercises. Honestly, none of my workouts really ever varied in exercises. I did the exact same thing every single week. And that's when I was the strongest.
Yeah, the most boring workouts are the best workouts.
Yeah.
They're most effective.
But but people always want to be doing something new, something different.
And you can still be effective doing that, but, you know, you have to... Personal training is somewhat like an entertainment thing, you know? People like to do different things, you know?
Entertain me, trainer.
Yeah, entertain me, trainer. You know, now there's a couple people that I've trained in the past that had I remember one, I don't know how you did it with John, and Matt. My workout routines when I had them were not that varied. You know, maybe some slight variations here and there, but they were pretty consistent. You know, there was a few exercise staples they did every single week, and it worked.
Well, they had very specific goals.
Very specific goals.
And if someone's goal is to just, I just want to come in and be healthy, you can vary your workout.
Oh, yeah.
Every week. Keep it interesting. Keep it fun. Try different stuff. But if you have a very specific goal of like, I want to bench 400 pounds, well, we are going to be extremely dialed in on your training process. It's going to look very, very similar every week. It can't just be off the cuff and just kind of random and just kind of, oh, whatever, we'll just do some of this week and this is kind of fun, you know, because you have a very, very specific goal that we're trying to reach.
Right.
So that's how those things differ. And 90+% of people don't have that extremely specific goal.
Yeah.
And so it's okay. But if you do, yes, it needs to look very, very similar week to week and well thought out.
I just remember when Matt and John would come in, I didn't even have to tell him what to do to get warmed up because it was the same every time, you know. And so they'd come in, and I'd nod my head, and they'd nod their head. And I'm like, okay, and so I could go train and do some other things as they're getting ready, you know. So because they were just used to the routine, and that was okay. You're right. If someone has very specific goals, then that's when the variety of exercises starts to dwindle down significantly.
Yeah, I would agree. Okay, I have, one more question in here for you.
Okay.
Is it okay for me to eat carbs? We've kind of touched on this a little bit already, but I want to expand more.
That's posed very out of context.
Well, the reason that this is such a common question, a lot of times it's more often females than males that will ask this, but people are kind of told carbs are bad.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to know whether all carbs are bad. And if it's ever okay to have carbs, which carbs is it okay to have? And how should they manage that? Because if all carbs are bad and you just go straight ketogenic diet, you don't even have to worry about carbs at all.
Yeah, I would say
that. But if it's okay to have some carbs, then how many and what carbs?
Well, again, I think carbs are dependent on... carbs in within themselves are a necessity for the body. Okay, so I don't get me wrong on that. You know, and I guess there would be, it's going to be based on what are your goals, right? What are you looking to accomplish? That's going to help me determine how much carbs you can have. Now, no matter, let's say I gave you, there's carnivore diets out there that are zero carbs.
Yeah, I've done that.
Yeah, zero carbs. Now, for my clients, I'll say on Sunday or whatever day you choose, usually it's going to be a Saturday or Sunday, I want you to have some carbs of your choice. As long as they're clean carbs, and scratch that itch, right? And there's different ways to scratch that itch, so to say, you know, like, you know, something you crave, you know. I think of another client that she loves chocolate. Okay, so she didn't have like chocolate on Saturday or Sunday. What she did is she'd buy a couple bars of Hershey chocolate, and she'd break all the little pieces off, and after each meal she'd eat a piece of chocolate. Okay, so she went from 163 down to 133 doing that. Still 90-10 rule. But it was just, she had a piece of chocolate and maintained that little piece of chocolate after every meal. And that was able to scratch that itch for her. It worked, right? That's another way of doing it. Most time, though, people have that piece of chocolate and then they put the whole bar in there because they can't, you know, discipline themselves just to have the piece.
So I can have like one piece of carb, like one little piece of bread or one grain of rice.
Yeah, one grain of rice. Well, like you probably have like a quarter cup of rice, but so you know, it's not that all carbs are bad. It's just that, you know, they have a specific purpose and they're processed in the body a certain way. And I'm a fan of using most of your fuel from fats. Now, all three of those turn into a form of glucose at some point, right? All three of them are used for fuel, right? It's just that some are used primarily for fuel. And, you know, I know if you listen to Mike from Renaissance Periodization, he just believes in... I listen to him talk about macros. He just believes in a calorie deficient scenario. You lose weight. He doesn't care what the macros are. I was like, interesting. You know, I listened to previous people I've worked for that believe that carbs need to be high and fats low. And for the same reasons I want fats high and carbs low. So, you know, there's different thoughts and theories out there of how to do it. I'm a fan of high meat, high protein, fats that burn quick, and keep the carbs low. That's just my approach.
It's kind of like every way can work, but one way is the best way.
Right.
Like, I will absolutely agree, you can get in very great shape with a high-carb, low-fat diet.
Right.
But I don't think it optimizes for health. I think, yes, you can get in good shape, but what underlying condition is your body and your organs and stuff in once you do that? Mm-hmm. Deprive yourself of fats that much. And I think that's the problem with that diet. So this is kind of a best of all worlds type of thing. I think it's best for performance. It's best for your short-term health, your long-term health, your longevity. Kind of balances everything together. Because mm-hmm. I've been at some different extremes throughout my life depending on what I'm trying to accomplish. And I've tried some different diets that super high carb, you know, low carb, high protein. I mean, tried it all for different reasons, but this is kind of the best balanced diet unless you're trying to do something really, really crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the best of all worlds.
Right. When you start getting into stuff like bodybuilding and doing shows, and now you're talking very unique macro plans that change as you get closer.
Well, and it just, it's different.
Yeah.
It's going to be a different diet, but you know that's a temporary thing. It's kind of like eating your Snickers bars at your bench competition. It's like, you're not doing that every day.
Mm.
It's just because of that competition that day.
You're right. Yeah. Still reminds me that, like, since I had the Snickers bar at the competition, my wife buys me a whole pack of Snickers. I'm like, why did you buy this? Well, I thought, you know, since you had them at the, it's like, no, that's not what that was for.
So now Matt's got a bunch of Snickers in his pantry that need to be eaten.
Yeah, no, they're gone.
Did you throw them away?
I don't remember what I did with them.
The gremlins probably ate them.
Yeah, the ones that usually eat all my food.
Yeah.
So, any other questions?
Nope, that was the last one. I'm sure I have a lot more, but maybe you'll just ask me some next week.
Yeah, well, I expect to have two young ladies on next week.
Well, then the next week, then.
Yeah.
In that case.
So,
well, that'll be exciting. Hopefully, we have them on. Either way, we'll be back here with another episode. Quickly before we leave, Matt, prediction for the Chiefs opener on Thursday.
I probably shouldn't be commenting on this, but you know, how's the Chiefs even looked in the preseason? They looked okay.
I have no idea.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to say, this based on last year, if Baltimore is pretty solid and they were, you know, I'm going to say, did Baltimore lose to the Chiefs in the championship game?
Yes, the AFC championship.
Okay, so they're going to, I say Chiefs lose.
That's not going to be popular. What score?
I'm going to say 28-24.
Interesting. I'll take the Chiefs 34-31. Field goal as time expires to win it.
Oh, nice. Yeah, well, I ain't going to get into I do know that sometimes Chiefs play their first game and they lose some early ones.
And, they did do that last year.
Yeah, and Baltimore's probably got a little bit of a chip on their shoulder. And I think what happens is the Chiefs get to where they are. They play a certain way with certain players, and so then the whole offseason, the teams that are getting to play them early are prepping for their new, how they finish that system, and then they're able to beat the Chiefs system, and then the Chiefs' athleticism, they develop new systems throughout the season, and they learn how to win with their new current players. I don't know.
Yep, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for joining us this week. Episode 32, we are excited to have it in the books, and we will be back next week for you guys with another episode.
Sounds good, guys. Have a great week, and we'll see you soon. Bye.
Hey, look at you. You've completed another milestone by finishing this episode of Loading the Bar. Your future self thanks you profusely. Loading the Bar is podcasted from Lee's Summit, Missouri. email us at cpt.kansascity@gmail.com. Forge ahead and share your progress. And we'll see you back here for another episode of Loading the Bar.